Today's episode of Ariel Helwani's MMA show contains explicit language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Back in your life on this Wednesday, November 27, 2019. Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. Welcome back to the podcast. Great to be here on this Thanksgiving Eve in New York City. If you're celebrating, hope you're getting ready for Thanksgiving with loved ones. It's one of the best holidays of the year. You get to sit around, eat a lot, and talk about what you're thankful for. I'm thankful for all of you. Honestly, sincerely, it's been a great year here at ESPN. I love doing this show, as I've said many a times. I'm excited and thankful for the fact that my Buffalo Bills are playing tomorrow afternoon. That's a big deal. First time since 1994. But in all honesty, there is a lot to be thankful for in the world of mixed martial arts. And each and every week on this particular program, we talk a lot about, you know, the news of the week, the fights, the events, the drama. But this particular week, I actually wanted to focus on a particular topic that doesn't get talked about enough, in my opinion. And that is the business of MMA. And so on this particular episode of the show, that is going to be the theme throughout. We are going to be talking to three influential people in the sport, maybe not household names, maybe not names that you may know right off the bat if I say them to you, but three very important people, and important because of three very different reasons. So we're going to be focusing on three different aspects of the business side of mixed martial arts. Later in the show, we're going to be talking to a man who is very important as far as sponsorship is concerned. His name is Hans Mollenkamp. I assure you, every single fighter and manager on the planet knows who this man is. You may not know who he is, but he is a very important figure as far as sponsorship is concerned, and that's very important for the fighters because when they're not fighting, this is how they make their money, and he helps support them. So I'm looking forward to talking to him for the first time. Middle of the show, we're going to be talking to Tiki Gossin, who is a former UFC / WEC and many other different promotions fighter. But now he has become a manager for the likes of Dominic Reyes, Rampage Jackson, Juan Archuleta, Brian Ortega. He's got a nice little stable going. And so I'm curious about making the transition from fighting to managing and what that is like for him. But first, very excited to say hello to a man who I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time. His promotion, KSW, based in Poland, has been doing wonderful things. And I'm very impressed with what they have built over there in Poland. And not just in Poland, but across Europe. They do things a little differently. I love the pageantry. I love the way the shows come across on television or on my device. And they've really built a nice foundation for themselves over there. So it is a pleasure and honor to say hello right off the bat to the CEO and co-founder of KSW, Mr. Martin Lewandowski, who's kind enough to join us from Poland today on the program. Martin, how are you?
I'm very well. It was a pleasure, you know, to hear all that story. And after so many years of, you know, being in the business, that we have a chance to talk and live.
Yes, it is a great pleasure. And I'm being honest and sincere. I'm a huge fan of what your promotion has been doing. I like that you do things a little differently. I love the pageantry and the pop and circumstance, and you guys have been doing a great job. And I know you have an event coming up in less than 2 weeks, and we will get to that. But first, I want to start at the beginning, because I understand the story of how KSW was founded is somewhat unique. How did you start KSW way back when, and when?
Oh, that was back in 2004. I was the promotion manager in Warsaw Marriott Hotel, so I was in hospitality business, and I was the one who was looking for different sports to promote for the Polish market, and I was in charge for everything what you can think of about the sport. It's not only general about the promotion of the hotel, the outlet, but sport was one of my aim. And I've been doing several different events, like with the Super Bowl, American football, with Formula One, etc. But, you know, from when I was a teenager, I was practicing different martial arts, starting from Kung Fu, then boxing, kickboxing, and then, of course, I end up with MMA. And that was something, you know, which was I was very passionate about for years. And in 2002 or 2003, because we count recall exact date. I've met my current business partner, Maciej, and we just sat, you know, in Champion Sports Bar. You guys know, you have to know that place. So we also have in Warsaw one of these. And we start talking, and we just find out that we have the same passion about martial art, that we know what pride was that day. We were very, we were a big fan of pride that day. And, you know, we just get together for quite a long time talking about the possible event. We call it KSW, which in translation is Martial Arts Confrontation. And we were looking for different fighters who represent different disciplines. And that's how we promoted. That's how we started to put the show together. So there was a kung fu guy versus karate, judo versus wrestling guy, etc., etc. So it comes with the passion of two guys. You know, coincidence, I might say, because I was the promotion manager who, besides, as I mentioned before, was promoting not only the hotel, but everything was around Poland. And I was looking and focusing for the new discipline. And, you know, pride that day was a huge, you know, that was something we really want to reach one day, the level of pride. And so after 15 years, because this year actually we are celebrating 15 years, our 15th year anniversary, I must say that we are kind of much better than pride used to be.
In those early days, back in 2004, 2005, what was it like trying to put on an event that you were trying to put on in Poland? What kind of attention were you getting? Was it hard to get people to come to the event to sell tickets? How difficult was it early on?
Oh, that was actually a horrible task, to be honest, because, you know, MMA was associated with every bad aspect you can think of, starting from the mafia people, cage fighting, dog fighting, you know, illegal fights, everything what you can think the sport shouldn't be, people were associating MMA. Plus, you had a huge lobby of boxing community, judo, wrestling. So these guys were also fighting with us because they knew what's coming. But yeah, but the first things of first our first steps were really fighting with stereotypes. So first couple shows, it was under the barter agreement, so there was no money involved, or there was some connection, like private connection. So we had to build something and show that this is the real sport. But thanks, I was working for this place I mentioned before, I had a lot of connection with media people. So that was something which really helped build KSW very fast and to speed up a little bit with the development. Because from the KSW1, I had Canal Plus, one of the TV station, who did maybe like kind of short, you know, movie about what's going on. It was more like a kind of news site. But from the KSW second, I already had a chance to get and sign the agreement with one of the biggest Polish sport channel. But that, from their perspective, was more like kind of investment for the future discipline. And they were right. Like, you know, they put on the right horse, house. But it was really horrible to talk and convince everybody that there is a sport, that it's nothing illegal in that, that there are rules. So I think in every country, probably like 15, 10 or 20 years ago, most of the promoters faced the same problem. Yes, there was no structure, there was no benchmark. You can show and say, oh, listen, we are going to do this and that, it will look like the same. So in Poland, it was completely zero. Of course, there was something going on, but it was more like in the discos, you know, in some dirty underground clubs. So the PR was really bad.
As you know, here in America, you want to put on an event, you have to have it regulated by one of the state commissions. Is there such a system in place in Poland? Was there one back then? And if not, is there one now?
No, there wasn't, and there isn't any. I have opened actually MMA Poland Association. This is another structure, another how to say, not the company because it's an association, which tried to build this in terms of making the real MMA Polish Association. So there will be structures, there will be, you know, a huge amateur community, but there is no regulated body who tells me what to do and how to do. Of course, there is a like general civil law which tells you what you can do if you are doing the mass event, but there is no like a sports commission. There is no like anti-doping commission which tells you what you. I mean, you have. I mean, we have kind of WADA sort of thing in Poland, but they cannot force me to do anything with that. You know, so there is. It's not like regulated. It's more like on based on the civil law or the law of making the huge massive event. This is something which I need to follow.
Okay. And in the early days, my understanding is you used to have a lot of one night tournaments, but you've stopped doing that. Why?
Because it was the cheapest, to be honest, the cheapest option. You have eight guys, eight man tournament, and you have seven fights, you know, in the same day. And of course, the money were completely different. Not only because it was like 10 or 15 years ago, it was just because you are not paying only for one fight, but you have, even if you are paying for three fights, so it's a different option. So that was just only economic reasons. But, you know, when we grew, when we become more professional, when we become more visible on the market, when we had the TV live coverage, when a lot of media started to talk about it, so we just suffered with all those injuries which happened during the tournament. So we started first, it was like, you know, Edman tournament in one day, in one show. Then we divided and split it into two shows. And then, like, I don't know, it was maybe after 10, I don't remember exactly when it happened, but when one day we decided that it has to be just one fight, every fighter has to fight one fight one night. Yeah, so, but it was just only economical reason behind it.
Do you recall when, what year, which event you started to feel like, okay, we are turning a corner, we're starting to make it, we're starting to make an impact, we're starting to become profitable? Do you remember when that happened?
Yeah, it was around, you know, KSW, I think it was KSW 6 or 7. That was actually the time when I started, and I quit my job. And I quit job, which was very decent job, to be honest, with a, you know, great salary, a perspective of a huge marketing career around the world. I'm talking about still in a hotel, but I got into so deeply into MMA and was so focusing on that I decided to quit. And that was 2006. And I just opened, you know, with my business partner, real company on the KSW brand. And we started, you know, to being professional promoter. And that was the day when I knew and I thought and I expected and I believed I can make much more money than I've been doing, you know, in working for the merit.
In 2015, after 37 events, you held your first event outside of Poland. You went to London, England for KSW 32, Road to Wembley. Why did it take so long to get out of Poland? And was that always part of the plan, or is this just a byproduct of your success? You started to realize, hey, we can make an impact outside of this country as well.
Yes, it's like, you know, when you started with such a lot of circumstance and that bad PR I was talking about. So we were happy when we go and we grew a little bit, when we start to see and people start to see us and perceive as a sports discipline. So England came very late. It was just because we didn't feel, you know, secure enough or confident enough that we can make it happen and we can make a success. Because that was something we didn't want to go outside of Poland, being so successful that day in Poland, and go abroad and just fail. So I think it took about a year just to organize and just to think, to analyze if it's a good move to go outside of Poland, if we can make the same impact. But, you know, it just, I know it's maybe for some businesses, it's quite a lot for 15 years to become you know, one of the top brands within the industry. But seeing or looking back in the history when you started with the ground zero, really, so I think 15 years is a really quite a decent time to build what we have built. And it's not like when I think about the past, so there wasn't like, you know, strategy that I knew that in 10 years I'm going to do this and that. No, when you grew, you just become more confident, you become more sure that you can make it happen, that you have some sources you can base off, your network is just bigger, you know how to deal with it. So this is why, you know, we just decided to go to London. Then we take another step to Ireland, and this year we came first time in Croatia. So, and we're not going to stop only on these three countries.
Now, you've done 50, you're about to do 58 events. You're about to have your 58th on December 7th, KSW 52. As you mentioned, 15 years doing this. Do you consider yourself competition for the UFC, or do you think you occupy a completely different lane? Do you not concern yourself with that?
No, of course we are, you know, in the same market, so we have to see each other as a competitors. But, you know, seeing what UFC is doing and how global they are, how big they are, so it's hard for me to tell that we are a competitor. For sure, if they are coming to Poland, so yeah. So I think even I must say that they are losing all the race with us in terms of, I don't know, media coverage, pay-per-view sales, how attractive the show is. So really, we are winning on. But this is our homeland. This is something, you know, we've been building and working for it for so many years. So it's just hard just to come do one show every 2 or 3 years. And just to expect that you are going to be so successful as UFC is in US. But globally, no. It's just like, you know, there are huge giants, and I know where is my place, and I know where KSW is strong, and where are our good assets, or where are good and weak points. So I'm realistic in that.
And so right now, like when we compare the UFC's popularity in Poland to KSW's, it's not even close. You're saying KSW is infinitely more popular, gets more attention media, fan-wise, than the UFC does.
That's right. And that's true. Like, probably that's what I found out, that like, people want to train UFC in US. So this is what happened in Poland. People want to train KSW.
Wow.
So this shows that we are such a huge brand, you know. I mean, of course it changes, but still we are like a pioneer in on this market. So we are the MMA here in Poland, you know. We have like 95% of the market, you know. So we're the biggest, definitely.
Could I ask how your purses compare to the other European organizations and maybe even to the UFC? Like, your highest paid fighters, what are they making?
A lot.
Okay.
I mean, you know, more than a million, that's the paycheck, you know, are paying right now. Of course, for the top fighters, but yes, that's the level.
And, you know, a typical big event, how much are you generating?
Can't tell, my friend. I know that this is sexy information, but this is something we are avoiding, you know, to answer for the last 15 years.
Why is that?
I want to keep it. I know. I mean, because there is no law, or I don't have to do it.
Right,
you know?
Okay.
So why should I tell, you know, because it always brings kind of crazy emotion to the people. I know that's what I said. It's a sexy information, but I know that, like, for example, in the U.S., you need to tell and declare how much you earn and how much. I mean, of course, all this financial institution in Poland, they know exactly, because, you know, we are a normal country, but we don't tell it publicly. And fighters doesn't tell how much they earn, so we don't have to tell how much they earn either. You know, so it's just like, I think there are some. I mean, you know, just compare. There were a couple of cases that some of our fighters refuses UFC contract because of the money. I mean, there was Michał Matella, there was Mamed Khalidov, and that was just because of the money. So it should tell you or give you the answer that we pay much better than UFC. Of course, in some cases, because it's like, for example, Mariusz Pudzianowski, the fifth-time strongest man in the world. He's our big star over here, but probably for UFC, he's maybe worth, I don't know, $10,000, you know, and right. He's earning here a fortune.
Could you say confidently, compared to the other European organizations, that you guys are the most successful in Cage Warriors, Bellator is doing, you know, European series, there was Bama back in the day. Like, do you think that you are the most successful European-based promotion right now?
I would say so, but I would rather ask you that question, how you see that.
Well, I don't see the numbers. I don't see the figures, but your events certainly are a massive, you know, the spectacle is incredible. I love the pageantry, like I said. I love the ring announcer that you have and how different everything is. I love that it has a little bit of pride to it as well. I guess the question I'm wondering is, forget Europe, do you have plans to come to the United States to expand and put on events here?
Yeah, but just let me answer the question, because okay. I think comparing with the Bellator and Cage Warriors, we are the only one. I mean, comparing maybe with the Cage Warriors, we are keeping our fighters, you know, in our team, and we can afford to pay them. That's one thing. The other, comparing with those two players, I don't think that they are selling pay-per-view. We do sell pay-per-view. We do sell pay-per-view in more than 92 countries. So this is something which also gives you the image of the show. We are doing the show, each hour show is around 10,000 people. Of course, we are doing sometimes 8, sometimes 12, sometimes 20, but average is 10,000. Neither Bellator, neither Cage Warriors, they are not doing that show, and we can name a couple other promotions. So this shows how successful we are. Of course, I don't like this comparison in a sense, because I'm working with these guys, but, you know, in terms of business, I think it depends what you are comparing. Pay-per-view sales, we are winning. You know, the number of the events in Europe, probably Bellator is winning. But, you know, the numbers of audience, we are winning definitely. You know, so it depends what you are taking under consideration. And about your question...
How many pay-per-views are you selling on average? Could I ask that?
No.
I mean, are you breaking 100,000?
More than that, of course.
200?
No. Average, yeah. We might say that this is like kind of average.
Okay.
Put it this way.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. So about the UFC, USA, KSW in US, there is a plan. I have a plan. But it's just, that would be a show like very orientated for the Polish crowd. It's just because I know that we have a Polish stars and they might be very attractive for Polish community living in US. That's why I just go, and I know, and I'm realistic, that's what I said, that the USA is the home of the UFC and Bellator, and it will be hard to compete. So it will be more like, you know, we are going to play the rock and roll concert for the Polish community in the US. That's how I see this. It won't be my second, third, or even tenth home of KSW. We are generating some revenue from the US, but because of the time difference and, you know, those two huge players, like I said. Now PFL also is growing very nicely. So... these guys have a huge competitors out there, so it will be more like, I don't know, every 4 years we'll just go and just show that we are alive, still alive.
Yes, well, you're doing a great job. Like I said, it has been a lot of fun watching the rise of KSW, and I always get excited when you have one of your shows because it's just different, and it feels new and fresh, but it also reminds me of the old days of Pride back in Japan, and you've produced a lot of great fighters, names like Karolina Kowalkiewicz. We saw recently Jan Blachowicz with a big win over Jacques Ray. You've produced a lot of Polish fighters, and you've given the opportunity for some other fighters to get opportunities to, you know, continue their careers and reinvent themselves. People like Scott Ashcombe and Norman Park, and of course, as you mentioned, Mariusz Pudzianowski, the world's strongest man, and you've got the great Mamed Khalidov coming back on December 7th as well. I'm looking forward to that. That is KSW 52. going down in Poland, and that's a big main event, Ashkim against Khalidov. So I want to wish you the best. This was a lot of fun, Martin. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you explaining what you guys do, what makes it so special, and I want to wish you all continued success, and hopefully we'll be able to see you here in the United States in the near future as well.
Yes, I'll be back probably next year, but not with the show, but I'll come, you know, just myself for Fighters Only Award, probably.
Yes, so, I know you were proud of that nomination, and I hope you do get another one.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ariel. I'm glad to, you know, hear and talk and had a chance to explain. Thanks for the invitation, man.
Anytime. We will talk to you soon. There he is, Martin Lewandowski, the co-founder and CEO of KSW. And so that's the promoter side of things. And of course, there are many different promoters working in MMA these days. Like I said, I mentioned some of those promotions. There's the UFC, the most dominant one. We talk about them a lot. Bellator, we talk about them as well. Cage Warriors, PFL. But I really was curious about this KSW promotion, which doesn't get enough attention here in the United States because they are doing a lot of their business in Poland, but they really do deserve a lot of that credit. They've had a phenomenal year, and they're putting on some massive shows over there. If you haven't had a chance to watch them, December 7th, next week during the day, it will not coincide with the UFC event. I do suggest you check them out because they really do put on a great event. So like I said, that's the promotion side of things. In a moment, we'll talk to someone who's involved in the managerial side of things. But before we get to that, let's pay some of our own bills. Let me tell you about our good friends over at Dollar Shave Club. Ooh, what is this? Is this more Thanksgiving music? What do we have here?
Yes, we're being very grateful today, Ariel.
I like that. Thank you, TST. Great choice. So, Dollar Shave Club. As you know, when I talk about Dollar Shave Club, I can't stress enough the quality of their products. They've spent years developing, crafting, refining, everything. They have everything I use to look, feel, and smell my best. You name it, they have it, and I use it. I've been a Dollar Shave Club member for the last 5 or 6 years, as I mentioned. I love the shave butter. I love the post-shave do. I love all their products. And as amazing as their shave stuff is, Dollar Shave Club is way more than just razors. Dollar Shave Club has you covered head to toe. They have everything you need to shower, shave, style your hair, brush your teeth, and yes, even clean your behind. And Dollar Shave Club can keep you automatically stocked up on the products you use. You get what you want, whenever you need it, whether that's once a month or a few times a year. I never have to waste time at a store wondering if what I'm getting is any good. As a Dollar Shave Club member, I know what I'm getting is the highest quality. And right now, you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's products to the test. Their Ultimate Shave Starter Set, has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, Post Shave Do. That's the one I like a lot. The best part is, you could try it for just $5. After that, the restock box ships regular size products at regular prices. Get your ultimate starter set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/Helwani. That's dollarshaveclub.com/Helwani. I love these guys. I really do love them. And I want you all to support them, and I want you all to try out, test their stuff, because it's really high quality. It makes you feel really good. Your skin feels great after you use them. So thank you very much to them for supporting us. TST hasn't given me the heads up. Is our next guest?
Yeah, Tiki's here.
Oh, you haven't told me. Usually give me the heads up. All right, so I'm excited about our next guest. Like I said, beginning portion of the show, we focused on the promotional side of things. Later, the sponsorship side of things. We're focusing on the business side of MMA. And one man who has done a great job of carving out his own niche in the business world, he went from fighter to now manager, which is a rare move. You'd think it happened more often in this sport, but it doesn't happen that often. His name is Tiki Gossin. He is a former UFC, WEC fighter, now manages the likes of Dominic Reyes and Brian Ortega and Quentin Rampage Jackson, Czech Congo, Juan Archuleta. Great guy, a legend of the sport, dare I say. He's kind enough to join us right now. Tiki, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Ariel.
It's good to talk to you.
You forgot one major part. Fighter, transition to trainer, then to manager.
That's right. There was an in-between there. Yes, thank you for letting me know. And also, arguably, the most famous goatee in the history of mixed martial arts with the blonde streaks in there. So let me ask you, when did you decide to make the move? Because fighter to trainer is a natural move. We see that quite often. But fighter to trainer to manager is not a move that we often see. When did you decide to make that move?
I'd say fell in my lap around when Bisbing left his management back in the day, Wolf Slayer. And you know, I was helping him out. I was training him as well, and started helping him, you know, with the communications and mediating things with the UFC and him. And through that, I kind of, you know, started to dabble a little more and a little more. And being a fly on the wall on many different discussions or different negotiations, you know, ranging back to when Tito Ortiz was, you know, prominent in the UFC. What we did is, you know, you just learn stuff. You gain experiences, you hear things, and it's a lot easier to navigate through these conversations and negotiations between the fighters and the promotion, because you kind of know both sides. What's benefited me is not just having a no bullshit type of conversation with the promoters. I get what they want. I know what the fighter wants, and sometimes, you know, what each of them want is a little bit skewed in their favor, of course, but as long as you can figure out, you know, the main points and figure out a way to make it mesh, it's a win-win.
When you were a fighter, how many managers did you have throughout the course of your career? You started back in 1998 as a pro, ended in 2009. How many managers did you have during that stretch?
So, oddly enough, my first manager was Dana White.
Really?
So I was one of the one of the first four MMA fighters that he was representing. It was myself, it was John Lewis, Chuck Liddell, and Tito Ortiz.
Wow, what year was this when you started working with him?
This was 2000.
Okay. How did you link up with him?
So back in the day, Tito and I were traveling to Las Vegas to train with John Lewis, and that's kind of like where the whole Tito and Chuck saga started, because they, you know, we were all training together. And John Lewis had met Dana and was kind of showing jiu-jitsu to the Fertittas and Dana White. And that's kind of how we all linked together.
Wow.
That was the connection.
And how long did you work with him for?
I think he was about almost 2 years, and then they bought the UFC, and he couldn't manage us anymore.
What was he like as a manager?
Dana's sharp. He's always been a sharp businessman. He's always had, you know, he's been in the boxing game, so he kind of understood. I think he managed a few boxers. There's Derek Harmon, and it was just a good experience. You know, it's kind of being able to see how he did it. You know, like I said, it's just one of those things. You're around from back in the day, and you just pick up things.
And after Dana, did you sign with someone else?
I've had a couple different guys. I had Dana, and then after Dana, I had Wayne Harriman help me out a bit. And then after that, it was Ken Pavia.
And so the reason I'm asking about how many you've had, like, do you feel like your experiences as a fighter, dealing with managers, dealing with promoters, but as a fighter, do you feel like this has helped you become a better manager? And does this give you knowledge that, you know, these other managers that come from maybe the law world or a different sport just don't have? They don't have that ingrained in them?
It's just tough, you know. Right now, the MMA landscape for managers and whatnot is kind of like the Wild Wild West, I think. There's not a lot of guys that have been in it from the beginning. There's not a lot of people that understand the sport from the beginning, and they think they can just come in and push their way through everything, you know, and keep pushing and keep pushing. Doesn't matter who they piss off. Doesn't matter who they cause friction with. So to answer your question, yes, absolutely. I think there's a huge benefit of, you know, being able to understand that and coming from that background.
What kind of relationship do you have with Dana White now?
I've always had a good relationship with Dana White. We've always been friends, which has been nice. I tend to not burn bridges with anybody. I like to stay friends. Haven't we been friends, Ariel?
We have. Yes, we've been a long time. Yes, and I was just wondering, because of course you have to have a good relationship with the UFC if you want to be successful managing fighters. So I was curious how you navigate that. But you also have fighters in Bellator and whatnot, and perhaps what's the difference between negotiating contracts with the UFC, the dominant league, and the other promotions?
I mean, right now is a unique time in MMA. It's kind of like back when Strikeforce was also prominent. What's happening now is the promotions are starting to pay comparable. So what it's doing is driving up the price, which is nice.
Why do you think that's happening now?
I think because, you know, there's other organizations. There's more money in the industry, and there's, you know, there's competition. Competition breeds success.
Yes. And it gives fighters more options, right? And it allows them to test the waters and see what else is out there. One thing that has been interesting to follow over the years was sponsorship, because as you know, when they instituted the Reebok uniform deal, a lot of fighters lost their sponsorship. But I have a theory, and I want to know how you feel about it. I feel like with the rise of Instagram in particular, fighters can actually earn more these days than they could have in the heyday of the Spike TV / sponsorship era, because now you can be seen by millions of people on your Instagram, have links over there, and it's actually a lot more beneficial for a sponsor as opposed to being on someone's butt and like, oh, you hope that someone Googles you and looks you up. Is it possible that, you know, this era of like there being no sponsorship money for fighters is over because of social media and in particular Instagram? Are you sensing that as well?
I am. I think everything is transitioned into social media platforms. That's where the money's at. That's where the fighters, that's where the athletes, that's where Instagram influencers can make their money. It's not just, you know, having the portal of the promotion. What's funny is, you know, back in the day, we used to do this and fend for ourselves with sponsors. You know, you'd have to go door to door. You'd have to go to companies that you liked and kind of do it for yourself. Like that's what I did. I remember one of my first sponsors, Hurley. I went in there. I met Paul Gomez, who was the marketing director, and I had to go in there and basically hustle for myself. So doing this from so long ago has helped me, and it's actually shaped me into being able to acquire deals for my athletes.
So like at your peak, what's the most you got as far as sponsorship is concerned for a particular fight?
For a particular fighter?
No, for a particular fight, like at your peak. Like, was there a certain fight like just to get a ballpark?
You want to laugh? You want to see what would get it? I fought in, what was it? UFC 40, Vendetta, at the MGM Grand.
Robbie Lawler.
You know what my fight purse was?
I'd love to know.
2-2.
Come on. Really?
I shit you not.
2-2?
Yeah.
What? That was on the pay-per-view portion of the card.
I know. So when I hear, you know, when I hear guys, you know, athletes, and that's one of the other reasons that I choose who I work with. I don't just say, I'm not just going to take on anybody. I got to, you know, I go through an interview process. I got to talk to them, see if they're down to earth, because I mean, they have it good right now. Fighters have it good, and everybody feels that they deserve all this money, but at the same time, it's, you know, I see it from the promotion standpoint too. It's like, okay, well, show me why you're worth that.
Mm-hmm. So wait, 2-2, what's the most you made for a fight?
What is the most I made for a fight? I think it was Strikeforce. I made 20 to fight Luke Stewart.
Okay, your second to last fight in 2008. Just 20 flat or 10-10?
Yep. It might have been 10-10.
My gosh. And for sponsorship, you were probably making nothing, right?
You're making about, you know, $1,000 a show.
Wow. So now you see what the guys are making now, and is there a part of you that's like, man, I wish I was fighting in this era? I mean, like, you know, not even to be a champion, but like a mid-tier fighter, they're not making that.
Always. I always think about that. And then I'll put like, you know, couple training sessions together and I go, okay, screw that idea.
Right. Well, you've thought this of coming hurt. Back?
This shit hurts. Yeah, I thought about it. You think about it all the time, but, you know, being a fighter and coming from that world, yeah, you get the itch every once in a while.
Let me ask you about being with a fighter. Like, you build up a fighter, you invest time, money, effort, you're helping train them, negotiate contracts, things like that, and then they leave you. What is that like?
It's part of the game, you know. I've seen it from the beginning. I've seen people leave managers. I've seen a lot of, you know, there's an entitlement. Some of the athletes you work with don't really know what you do for them, and they don't understand. So you can't really blame them. And there's no sense in, you know, essentially crying over spilled milk. You just kind of, you know, let them transition. Okay, no problem. Here you go. You know, you can't hang on to everybody. So you're with an athlete for a certain period of time, you do the best possible work you can for them, and either they like what you're doing and stay, or they think the grass is greener on the other side and they take off.
Do you have a contract with them, or can they take off whenever they want?
No, of course you'd have a contract with them, and they'd have to settle up the contract before they leave. But
okay.
What I'm saying is, you know, just, you know, it's not like, you know, back in the day, you'd get managers trying to strong arm their athletes and keep them there.
Right.
You know, leeching off them and whatnot.
And what about recruiting fighters? Because one thing that I hear about a lot is like, oh, this guy's trying to poach that guy, and this guy's trying to take my guy away, and this and that. What's your stance on that? Is it all fair game, or, you know, do you just wait for someone to come to you? Do you try to find your own people?
I usually wait for them to come to me. I'm okay. Not going to go poach somebody. That's not my style. It's like if somebody has a manager, it's like, look, figure out your deal with them. And if, you know, if they release you or you're not with them anymore, you don't have a manager, you need some help, yeah, we can talk. But again, it's going to be an interview process.
Right. You're not just going to take anyone. You want to kind of vet them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm not a volume agency. I'm more of a, you know, niche boutique style agency.
And is it just you, or do you have any partners?
It's just me.
Just you. Wow. And so how do you decide who you're going to actually train as well and manage, or do you train all the guys that you manage?
You know, that's a good question. So I've wanted to transition out of that. There's a few athletes that I love training that I see their drive and I see their work ethic, and also I've just been there with them. I've been a training partner of theirs, or we have a friendship, and I like to help everybody out. So I think I have enough knowledge in the game where the input I give kind of helps out. So it's not like I'm going to go in there and be like, okay, look, I'm your manager and I'm your coach. The only guys I do that for are basically Rampage and Congo.
Okay.
And then sometimes Juan Archuleta, I'll help him out with a couple camps.
Now, recently you got some great news because one of your guys, Dominic Reyes, is going to be fighting on February 8th against John Jones for the light heavyweight title. In that particular situation, how does that work from your perspective? Because obviously John is the big dog, right? He's the A-side. He's the champ. He's the one that everyone wants to fight. Does your guy get a new deal? Without trying to go into too much specifics, I know you don't want to piss anyone off, but does your guy get a new deal as a result of this title fight, or is it just the same deal and you have to take it?
I think my guy is extremely happy. You might want to ask him.
Okay. He's happy about this.
He's ecstatic.
And then things change if he wins, right?
I think things always change when you're holding the belt.
Right. And he would be your first UFC champion?
No.
Who did you have as UFC champion?
TJ Dillashaw.
Oh, that's right. Of course. You had him. We had a nice conversation with.
Oh, you just forgot about TJ?
Well, no, I sort of. He's not champion right now. And wait, did you have him when he won the belt, or did you have him while he was champion? That's what I kind of.
While he was champion.
See, this is different. This is a guy that you're kind of with prior, so it's a big difference in my opinion.
Oh, prior to having the belt. Yeah, okay, I see that.
Okay. And can I ask about that? Like, just being now the manager for someone who's out for 2 years suspension, he's owned up to it. I think he's done a phenomenal job of doing that, but he's lost sponsorship, right? You have to sort of stick with him through this and now try to eventually in a year or so build him back up. How difficult
is
that?
We're already in that process.
You
we're
are?
Already in that
what
process.
Does that mean?
Yes. Meaning we're, you know, sponsors are coming back around. People are wanting to become, you know, come back around. You know, people are following him with his, road to recovery.
Right.
You know, he had 2 shoulder surgeries. He's coming back, and I think we're going to see a better TJ Dillashaw when he's able to fight.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
That's than before, good. which is scary to think about.
If there's one thing that you could change about the business of MMA, what would it be? What would you like to see done differently?
I don't know. That's a good question. It just seems like right now, anybody who thinks they want to be in MMA can get into MMA. I guess the how you got to go through the fire. I don't think a lot of people have gone through the fire to be able to be in this industry, if that makes sense.
Okay. So you think there are a lot of people kind of clogging the space, pretenders looking to make a quick buck?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, from fighters to agents to, you know, just people in it, you know, people trying to leech into the market. I've run across some companies that have been trying to come into the game that, you know, they're in it to make a quick buck. They're in it to try to make a quick turnaround, or they're in it for the wrong reasons and they're not really into MMA, but they're just into it because they think, ooh, the return on this might be good. And it's weird. It's a crazy time in the sport.
If I would have told you 10 years ago that it would be where it's at today on ESPN, the fighters making what they're making, would you have believed me, or has the success of the sport exceeded your expectations?
Ten years ago, yes. 15 okay. years ago, I would have been, when I was still active, I would have been like, fuck. There's no way. I mean, we were doing this back in the day. We were fighting. We weren't even fighting for money. We were basically fighting for, you know, bragging rights.
Right.
Who's the toughest?
Right.
You know? Oh, and by the way, you just fight your ass off, and now here's $1,000.
Right. Enjoy.
You know, cash. Here's $2,000. You're like, oh, thanks. You know, so it was never about that.
Do you think the purses can get even bigger, comparable to boxing, or do you feel like we've hit a ceiling?
No, I think it's changing. I think it's definitely changing, and I think the purses will get bigger.
Trending in the right direction.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Like from now in the next 5 years, yeah, we'll see a huge change.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, this has been great. Congratulations on all your success as a manager. And, of course, you know, you had a great career, a nice career. I wasn't around as much for your career. I watched it, didn't cover it as much. But now you've built a really nice stable. And congratulations on getting the Dominic Reyes fight February 8th in Houston. I'm looking forward to that as well. Thank you for doing this, Tiki. I know you're very busy helping Brian Ortega prepare for his fight against Chan Sung Jung. So we appreciate the time very much today.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Ariel.
All right, there he is. Tiki Gossin, the manager, like I said, for the likes of Ortega and Reyes. TJ Dillashaw, of course, we spoke to him on Monday, trying to build himself back up. And the great Rampage Jackson, who returns in December in Japan. Later in the program, I'll give you a little news about Bellator and the Japanese market. Also, talk a little bit about the Khabib Nurmagomedov Tony Ferguson fight that's been in the news this week. But for now, let's talk to the last of the trio of guests that we wanted to talk to today about the business side of the sport. So spoke to a promoter, spoke to a manager, former fighter turned manager. Now let's talk to someone who is on the sponsorship side of things. And like I said at the top, perhaps not a household name to the casual fan, but I can assure you that every fighter / manager / coach knows who Hans Mollenkamp is. So let's say hello now to Hans Mollenkamp and find out why he is so instrumental to the fighters, why he's so important, why so many love him, and why so many hope that he sticks around for a very long time. Hans, how are you?
Good. How are you, Ariel?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on the show, and you are so influential as far as the business side of the sport is concerned. So if I did a show like this where we focus solely on the business side of MMA, I had to have you on because I think that you have done an amazing thing for fighters over the years, and I think your story needs to be told. And you're one of the few people who actually is able to work harmoniously with the UFC and Bellator, which is a nice feather in your cap. First, let's talk how you first got introduced to the sport of mixed martial arts. When did that all start?
1999, Ken Shamrock's Lion's Den. I have stumbled in there like just by sheer coincidence. I worked in action sports for a long time in the skateboarding industry. And I just wanted to do something different. So I went in there and started training. And I didn't really like it that much there. And I kind of made my way over to City Boxing in San Diego, where Dean Lidster was training out of, and Jocko Willink. And I just kind of stayed there and, like, got really, really deep into jiu-jitsu and Thai boxing with those guys. And then from there, I sponsored Dean for a couple of his pride fights for the shoe brand that we were doing. And I saw the results. And this is, like, early 2000s. And I went and cornered Dean with Jocko for those pride fights, and I saw the reaction, and I saw the reaction that we were getting from a business point of view of what we did. And it was, you know, even though it was so like niche at the time, it still radiated, and I knew there was something there, and that's where I really started getting deep into the business side of MMA.
And what shoe brand was that?
Osiris.
Okay. And so once that happens, how do you then take it to the next step?
So we were sponsoring Dean, and then what subsequently happened was that, you know, there was that golden age where Tuff was, you know, starting to pop off. And, I was meeting, a lot of guys coming down to our gym, which one of them was Diego Sanchez. And, we ended up sponsoring Diego for his, I think it was either the Tuff finale fight or one. It was a fight against, I think, Kit Cope. And again, we just saw we saw the result. Like everyone that was working with the brand, and we're a really big brand in action sports and skateboarding, and we didn't. I knew how it was tracking, but my partners and everybody else at that brand at that time didn't understand how big it was getting. But we, like, the next day, you know, everyone that had watched that fight, you know, because I think it was on Spike back then, they were calling us, going, "We saw your logo. We saw your logo. Oh my God, you guys are sponsoring fighters!" And it was just catching. So I started. Then I just moved on and I started working with, you know, like I did Brandon Vera. I did. We made Rampage a shoe. Like,
wow.
We were just doing a bunch, and then in 2000 and I think it was like late 2005. That's when I broke off and I started my own company, Throwdown. And I was building cages and gyms, and that's when I started making this. First, started making equipment and apparel, and that was when I got like seriously deep into it. And I made Scott Coker's second cage for Strikeforce, and I mean pretty much everybody's cage for all the gyms around. And like we were manufacturing, like I mean there was a new like fight promotion every week, and we'd just be making cages for them. And those were a whole different time. And then, you know, and then I went from there, and you know, had a partner fall out, and I started my brand, Triumph United, which, you know, stuck around and still doing that now too, you know. And that's just a fully equipment brand, and you know, we worked with a lot of people from the start, you know. I mean same kind of names, Kimbo and Rampage. I mean, worked with Connor back in the day, worked with, I mean, the list goes on. I mean, pretty much anyone that needed gear in the start of their career, you know, in those early days, we would work with them. And, we were working with UFC, paying the tax back in before the Reebok days. You know, I've seen it from every single angle, from being an owner of a business to obviously doing what I'm doing right now for one of the largest sponsors in the space.
And we will get to that sponsor in a moment, but I'm just curious about the post-Tough boom, because during that boom, you know, the sport was starting to get really popular, but there was also like a gazillion brands out there. And you, as you mentioned, Throwdown, you had Triumph. What was that period like? Like, how hard was it to actually break through and make money during that period?
Okay, so the only reason, I mean, I came from a direct, you know, marketing background in a comparable sport, which is, like I said, action sport. So MMA was like kind of like a fringe thing at that point. And I had the tools from being a photographer, being a marketing guy, understanding how to get the sales out there, that I didn't have to go and rely on trying to build this massive business like everybody else was, like dumping money, like insane amounts of money, you know, into trying to start these businesses. And then they were paying the athletes an exorbitant amount based on really just no one could ever really justify what the reason why for the, you know, the amount of sponsorship. Like, so one fight would be like, oh, it's $20,000 for a leg, or the next fight could be $5,000. It's just, it would be bouncing all over the place. And that's why you saw it. I mean, the barrier to entry, it's just like, you know, a lot of things in this sport was really low. If you had some money, you could start a brand up and you could get right in. And if you were a fan, you know, if you're just a fan of the sport, you could get next to these fighters. You could get next to the sport in a way that you never were able to in the past. And you would see these people, you know, that had no knowledge of real business, you know, like, you know, marketing, manufacturing, anything. They just wanted to be involved, and they would leverage everything they had, you know, their 401k, their house, whatever, just to start these brands in the sense that they thought they were going to be the next, you know, at the time, Tap Out or Affliction, whatever. And, you know, they would just go and they would just blitz it. And then you see a brand, you know, out there for, you know, a couple months, and then it'd be the next brand and it'd be the next brand. And with me, I mean, I just kind of just, I was in it for the long haul. I was never in it to, you know, like I saw it differently. I was like, I knew that the sport was going to grow. I knew that the sport was going to evolve into something like it is now. So I just, you know, I just cruised it and just, I knew that it wasn't going to be, you know, we made quite a bit of money in the first couple of years just because the industry was just on fire and everybody was picking it up. But then once the crash started happening and the retail crash happened, you know, I saw everybody lose. And, you know, I was, you know, I still had a shoe brand. So, I mean, I was just kind of doing both at the same time and just cruising it. And I was able to maintain having my brand through, you know, I mean, it's close to 14 years now. Because I was never in it to just get rich. I was always in it to make better equipment, or, you know, just basically do it to help the athletes out. I mean, because I, you know, obviously I'm really into it myself. I train daily. I mean, it's still my life. Like, this isn't like I mean, as much as I am a definite fan of the sport and a fan of what this has become, I mean, you take it all back, and I would still just – my whole thing is that I'm a practitioner of martial arts, and I love it. So it doesn't make a difference to me if I make money or if I don't. I just want to make sure that there's something there long-term for the athletes to be able to have.
And now you're the director of combat sports for Monster Energy, and that's the brand that I was talking about that you see very visibly on the UFC octagon, on the canvas. You also see them very much a part of Bellator these days. How did you get linked up with Monster, and then how did you help get Monster so involved in the world of combat sports?
So roughly around like 9 or 10 years ago, Monster's been involved in MMA for it's going on close to 10 years now. And it was a very slow, gradual process. One of a very, very close friend of mine who is the senior director of all action sports at Monster brought me on to start working on a developmental program for Monster. It was a very rudimentary program that we had no idea where it was going to go. And when I say that, I'm talking about like it started off with like two athletes. You know, I mean, the first two athletes, you know, that were on it were Michael Chandler and Dominic Cruz. And then we added Tyrone Spong. And then we added Rampage Jackson. And like they were just guys that all like, you know, like I said, they're people that I've always worked with that I always knew could, you know, like not only carry the brand well, but I knew that they would be good represent, you know, they would represent the brand in a way that it would help grow it. And so all of them combined, you know, through the years helped get it to that next level where you had Chandler and Bellator. You had, you know, at that time you had Rampage was in Bellator. He was moving in from Bellator. He did have a fight back in the UFC and then came back to Bellator. And Tyron Spong was in the World Series of Fight. And we had sponsored. So how it worked out was the first event we ever did was a event in Hawaii that Rich Chow did. And it was a Elite XC event. And I think that was it. Pro Elite was the one that – I'm confused right now.
Yeah, yeah. Pro Elite was the parent company, but Elite XC was the event. And Rich Chow was one of the matchmakers.
Yeah, well, there was one that he took over, and they changed back to Elite.
Oh, that's right. They did. Event. They went back to Pro League. Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, so he did that. Yeah, he did that. And I it was the first time that we put the logo, and I got it approved to be on the mat. And so that was the initial start of it. That started it. And then the secondary part was the World Series fight, where we did a couple fights with them. And then it went from there to Bellator. And then once it was in Bellator, it exploded because then I was able to use it and kind of utilize it, a lot of the same, you know, sales and marketing tactics that we had utilized in action sports and apply it to, you know, to MMA and to the beverage world, which was, you know, like getting a lot of the retailers involved and getting, you know, the sales guys involved to show that there was a deep, you know, meaning behind this whole program. And, once that happened, you know, the brand saw the enormous potential of what MMA was doing, the visibility and how well, like, you know, these athletes did for the company. So that quickly expanded the brand as we got more athletes involved. And then we had the opportunity to work with the UFC. And we did the deal with the UFC concurrent with the deal we had with Bellator. And, you know, they're two totally different, you know, companies. And in my mind, you know, like as I didn't feel like we needed to do one or the other. I felt that, you know, I wanted to be able to, because I've seen how this industry has treated the fighters. Like, and I'm not saying, you know, like I wanted to be this massive, just like brand blanketing over everything, but that's truly what it became, you know? And, you know, we wanted to be able to work with, you know, athletes in both spaces, which we do currently now. And so we have the opportunity with the UFC. We took it. We, you know, we became the center mat sponsor for the UFC along with, you know, with Bellator. And then we added, now we're working with, you know, Glory Kickboxing also. So we've expanded the brand into, you know, a very large sphere of MMA influence, having, you know, some of the greatest names ever attached to it, as well as some of the best organizations.
You've seen and done it all as far as sponsorship is concerned. You saw the boom and the crash, as you mentioned, and now the era that we're in now. And I was talking to Tiki about this, our previous guest, and I'm wondering, I mean, you would know the answer to this question better than anyone. There was a time early on in the Reebok era, as that kicked off, that everyone was lamenting the fact that sponsorships are gone, fighters can't make any money, they're making peanuts, the Reebok deal isn't helping the fighters, it's hurting the fighters, etc. And I'm wondering now, with the advent of Instagram and social media, if actually fighters can make more money than they ever were able to make in the tough era. Is that possible?
Well, look, I think that's a two-part question. And the first part is yes. I think that fighters absolutely can make more money if they actually set themselves up right with, you know, a team and understand how the marketing aspect works, right? You can't just expect to be sponsored. And I say this all the time, just because, you know, you're you know, like, just say hypothetically, the number one fighter, undefeated, whatever, but you don't have a strong marketing base and you don't have a strong following and you're not doing all the things that really require you to become, you know, a face, not only of MMA, but a face outside. You're going to be limiting yourself, you know, from the sponsorship perspective, where, you know, years ago, you know, a lot of the agents would just, you know, they would do the hypothetical and say, hey, you're going to, you know, they would come to me and say, hey, like, if I put a, you know, like I could put your logo on, you know, the shorts, and millions of people are going to see it. And I would tell them the same thing. I go, but that doesn't equate to millions of sales. I mean, like, yeah, a lot of people may see it, but that doesn't mean that a lot of people are going to buy it. And now, you know, with social media, you can actually track that much better. You can. So it's been, and it's growing in a way that if you do have that set up, you know, you could be on, you know, you could be an up and coming fighter and have a very large reach and make a lot of money and do pretty well, and also help, you know, get your career jump started with the organizations just because you have that kind of reach. But if you're not doing the work and you're just basically like, okay, I'm just this great fighter, I'm not going to apply too much into marketing or building brands or branding myself, you know, but I should be getting paid. That's not going to work either. So the probability of making more money now is much higher just because there are more aspects and are definitely more like ways to do it to gauge the metrics than before. And I think that now the sport is definitely more recognized. It's definitely more cleaned up. There's a lot more like legit sponsors that are willing to take, you know, like longer contracts out with athletes to really have them get behind the brands. And, you know, they could use it in multiple phases too, whether it's social media, whether it's on-site activation, whether it's just name and likeness to put it on catalogs and display them on commercials. There's a lot more out there right now. So yeah, this is it's a very good time for athletes. If they do it right, they can make a lot of money.
How many fighters do you sponsor right now?
For Monster?
Yeah.
I think it's close to 32.
Wow. And in total?
Yeah.
All your brands? Because you...
Oh, in total, all the brands? I mean, shit, there's probably like 70.
Really? Okay. And so would you say that you're directly involved with sponsoring the most fighters in the sport today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in a way that is, and we don't do one-off deals. Like, the deals that I do, they're longer deals. I mean, I won't do anything less than a year. And, you know, I'm directly involved with working with the athlete and, you know, the agents. And a lot of it comes down to just knowing, like, hey, this is a partnership. You know, as long as we know that we can work together, we're going to stay together. I mean, like, a lot of these guys have worked with me for a very long time. And most of it's because I know that they could perform for the brand. And, you know, I have people I have to answer to. When you're dealing with a publicly traded brand that, you know, is worth billions of dollars, you know, you're under a microscope. And so if somebody is going to ask me, like, why do we have, you know, so-and-so a part of our team, what do? I have to come up with a very, very clear and concise answer fast. And so, you know, everybody serves a purpose and everybody, you know, plays their role. And that's the thing, is that, like, I have to be very, you know, in touch with these guys and knowing, you know, what their limitations are and what they could actually provide.
One thing I've always been curious about is, you know, you have the Reebok deal, but then you have those fighters where they also get the Monster logo on the deal. How does that get determined? Do you guys pick those fighters? Is that in conjunction with the UFC? Is that separate from the deals that you do outside of the fights? How does that work?
No, it's just it's a completely separate deal that we do on our own.
Okay.
So like, you know, I mean,
Connor,
Jorge Masvidal,
right?
Or yeah, I mean, like it's a separate deal that I work out directly with the athlete, and then, you know, we kind of lay out the plans on how, you know, what we're planning on doing with them, how they're going to, you know, how they're going to be associated with the brand. You know, I mean, like there's some of them that are very, you know, like, hey, look, you're we're going to target you heavy, you know, in Latin America. We're going to target you heavy, you know, in Australia. We're going to target you heavy, you know, for Europe. And we have very, you know, structured conversations about where they're going to go and why they're a part of what they're doing, what the expectations are, and you know, where their future is with us. And I'm not a kind of person that's just going to like just dump you because you lost a fight. You know, I mean, I look beyond that. I look at the person, I look at the overall, you know, person and how they could be a part of what we're doing and how they benefit the brand to a much greater level.
Yeah, I know that actually firsthand because I've had a lot of managers and fighters say to me, like, thank God for Hans, thank God for Monster. You know, we haven't fought, we haven't won, we've been injured. I don't think a lot of fans realize that, like, when you're not fighting, you're not getting paid. But people like you are helping them get a steady paycheck and sticking by them. So let me ask you about tough decisions. If a guy, like, you've reached the end of the road, whether it's he's not winning, he's not active, maybe doing things that you don't want associated with the brand, how difficult is it to cut ties when you're with someone for several years?
It's difficult, man, because you get, you know, they're family, and it is becoming one of those things that, you know, that you know, like for me, I mean, I travel a lot with these guys. I personally, you know, shoot photos of them for the brand. Like we're in there deep, and like you have to have, you know, a little bit of a different relationship than just a phone call relationship. You know, it's not easy. And a lot of times I do start giving them the heads up, you know, and I'm like, hey, look, we're here, and when we get to there, like, if this doesn't happen, you know this is what's going to end up happening with us. And I have to be honest about it, and I have to let them know that you know, that unfortunately we can't go on if this is where you're at and you know, nothing's changing. And they get it, you know, like, and I I've never been in a part of a situation where somebody just completely lost it on me that like they felt that they needed to be a part of it. But you know, most of the time it's a hard phone call to have. Like, you never want to have it, you know, but I also encourage them to understand that, like, look, I'm not shutting the door on you, and I'm not ever saying that, like, this is it, like you can't come back. I mean, I'll just give you an example, is that I've had this conversation with two people in the last year that was really tough. One of them was John Jones and one of them was TJ Dillashaw, and they're both friends. And you know, like you work with these guys, and you know how they are as, you know, as athlete and people. And you know that, like, you know, outside of all this, or, you know, like there's things that happen, but you know, they're good people, and you know that they're worth their weight in gold when they're on. So you have those conversations. And like with John, I was like, hey, look, I need, you know, I got to, you know, at this point right now, we got to move forward, and we're going to move forward, you know, until you figure out or whatever happens with your career. And once you're back in it, we can review it. And let's talk about, you know, you coming back to us when that time is right. And that happened, and he did come back, and I put him back on the team. So it's not like the door is shut forever. And it's the same thing with TJ. I definitely told him the exact same thing. You know, and I mean, like TJ and I are really close. I mean, I was with him the other day, and like, it's not always about like the money and the sponsorship and like, that's it. And like, we're done. Like it has to go deeper than that. And that's where the real magic happens from building a really cool crew and team. Cause then there is a team. It's a strong unity between the athletes and the fighters and the brand.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You were with John the day he found out about the positive test after the Cormier fight, right?
I was sitting next to him.
Wow.
Right next to him. I was with him. We were we had just got done doing a photo shoot at Jackson Wink, and we went to go eat. We were in New Mexico. We went to go eat at the Elephant Bar, and it popped up on our phone. It was a TMZ report, and it was a very, very hard day.
That's how he found out?
How I found out, I think he got up. Like, that whole thing was a blur, but I think he had gotten up and gone to the bathroom. He's looking at his phone. I was looking at my phone, and we sat down and we looked at it together. And
wow.
Then it just like, and then it became a very, very emotional roller coaster. And it sucked, you know? And I mean, I would never wish that upon anybody. That was a horrible, horrible experience.
I'll ask you in conclusion the question I asked Tiki at the end of our chat. If there is one thing about the business side of MMA that you would like to see change, done differently, What comes to mind? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but is there anything that comes to mind?
The barrier to entry.
Okay.
Look, other sports have a much harder barrier to entry. And I'm not talking about the athletes. I'm talking about the business side. I'm talking about, people that are starting, coaches and gyms and, companies and 100%, people that represent, athletes. And I think that you have to look at this as a professional sport and treat people professionally and realize that, like, you can't go and ride the line on trying to be, like this hard edged, I'm representing people and this is what I'm doing. It's fair for them. And then all of a sudden, like, threaten people at the same time in a way that's unprofessional and completely puts, financial lives and, all kinds of stuff in jeopardy. And like, it's not good. And I really wish there was a way to vet people out a little bit better and have it like it is in other professional sports where it's not like anybody could just come in and do these jobs. Like, you have to be somewhat accredited or there's some sort of, like the agency or somebody that's overlooking this so that you're not getting this, people that are being, managed or being represented by somebody that could for sure ruin their career, based off, whatever personal motives or whatever it may be. And I've seen it happen far too much, and it's happening like way too much, in this day and age. And I really wish it wouldn't, cause I see how it affects the athletes. And I think that it's wrong. And I hope that it changes soon.
You're doing a wonderful thing, my man. Honestly, let's be honest, the fighters, they don't get paid, in my opinion, what they deserve. And it's people like you, in large part, who help them be able to fight and continue chasing this dream of being, one of the top fighters as far as earners are concerned. And you keep that dream alive. And I know how, the fighters feel about you and the managers feel about you. And it's amazing to develop that reputation in this particular sport. So congratulations on all your success on everything that you've done in MMA and continue to do. And it was great to learn more, about your history, about where you came from and how you built all of this. It's really impressive.
I appreciate that, man. And I appreciate everything you do for the sport too. Without people like you, it's very hard, for a lot of people to get this great information and hear all these great things about how this industry is shaping up. So you're doing an amazing job too, my friend.
Thank you, Hans. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. There he is, Hans Mollenkamp, director of combat sports for Monster Energy. And as he mentioned and outlined, he's been involved in the fight game for quite some time. And one of the very important figures in this game that maybe you don't know, but without him, the fighters aren't making all that much money, especially the ones who are trying to make a name for themselves. I mean, obviously the Conor McGregors of the world are, doing just fine with or without sponsors, but the sponsors help in between. Look, Conor hasn't fought, right? He hasn't fought since October of last year, and I'm pinpointing him, but every manager fighter will tell you, if you don't have sponsors, you're struggling. And that means that the people aren't connecting with you. That means you're not getting big fights. The spotlight isn't on you. It's a very important part of this game. And it was scary for a lot of fighters when the Reebok deal was brought in. And I talk a lot about the Reebok deal as far as like stripping away their personality. But the truth of the matter is, forget about the personality. It took away their income when you took away those sponsors, the banners, all that stuff, not letting them wear things at media day, post-fight press conference, etc. And it's been loosened up a little bit, but still, it took a while for, the fighters to start to get back on that same track. And I think social media helped them out a lot. And so I think that that's something that people aren't recognizing. I heard, obviously, Paige VanZant was on my show and she told me about that, and that created a big, a big stir. But a lot of fighters are doing well as a result of social media. I joked recently that Jorge Masvidal's Instagram reminds me of that scene in Wayne's World where, they're hawking all these different products. And of course, I'm joking. I'm happy for them. I want the fighters to get paid as much as possible. They all deserve more, from the top all the way to the bottom. They all do. So, great to hear Hans's story and a lot of fun doing this particular episode, focusing on the business side of MMA. I don't consider myself a business person per se, but I do love the business side of the fight game. And so it was cool to hear those three different perspectives. Before we go, a couple of news and notes. Actually, while we were doing this podcast, Bellator dropped a pretty big one on us, announcing that the bantamweight champion for their organization, Kyoji Horiguchi, has relinquished their title. This is the press release. It's pretty short. After suffering a severe injury that forced him to undergo surgery, Bellator bantamweight champion Kyoji Horiguchi has relinquished the title he won last June at Bellator 222. With the championship now vacant, Bellator will move to book a 135-pound title bout in the coming months. There is a quote in this story from Scott Coker, Bellator president, and the main part is, after fully healing, we plan to give Kyoji an immediate title shot. Of course, he's also the Ryzen champion as well. So that's a pretty big piece of news. The other big story that's been percolating this week has been Tony Ferguson versus Khabib Nurmagomedov. ESPN reporting on Monday that the UFC is targeting it for April 18th in Brooklyn, New York. And that is accurate. That is what they want. Khabib himself saying recently that he wants to fight in April and that Brooklyn was the front runner. But something weird happened, and I don't know if weird is the right word, but something that happens sometimes when these big fights are being negotiated happened Monday night, where you see Khabib's side start to flaunt the fact that they have a signed bout agreement. Let's go, Tony. Here's our bout agreement. Now it's on you. And you don't hear much from Tony. Tony emerged Tuesday night and said that on Twitter, he wrote that, you know, time to play games are over. I'm open for business. And it was a bit of a mixed message. I think that if you did not really know what was going on, you would think that he was confirming that the fight was done deal. The video would certainly suggest that. But what he was saying was like, let's talk. Let's talk business. You want this fight. I want this fight. Let's talk. And something that's happened over the past few years in the UFC is we all know about the rise of the money fight, the mega fight, in large part because of Conor McGregor's success and popularity. And over the last year or so, the UFC has tried to, you know, stop a lot of that money fight talk and get things back on track for them. It was almost like the inmates were running the asylum. It was starting to become a lot like boxing, where fights were being negotiated every single time. It didn't matter if you had a 4-fight deal, an 8-fight deal, a 6-fight deal. You were renegotiating every single time. They don't want this. And so they have started to put their foot down a lot more and just said, like, take it or leave it. And often the fighters are taking it because at the end of the day, the UFC has all the leverage. They're the promotion. They're the ones with the belts. You have to fight for them. And we saw this with Usman and Covington. And early in the talks, and remember, this fight is, what, 4.5 months away? We're starting to see the same thing here with Tony. So I hope that they're able to talk. I hope that they are able to give Tony a deal that is fair and is something that he, you know, I think has earned and is worth, and that it's not just, okay, Khabib is the big star. He is the A side. Let's get him done. And Tony, you're just going to take whatever it is you fought Donald Cerrone for. Because in my opinion, what he fought Cerrone for has nothing to do with what he's fighting Khabib for. This is a title fight. This is a main event. The whole show is going to be built around this fight. It's a different circumstance. It's a different fight. Can't just take the same thing. And so in the post-Zuffa old regime era, now the WME Endeavor era, new people have been brought in and they're trying to put their foot down and say, like, look, you want to negotiate, go elsewhere because it's not happening here. And that's created some friction and that's created some really tense times between fighter slash manager and promoter. And so I'm really curious to see how this story plays out. But this particular story is not done. This fight is not done. We know the date. We know what they want. But Tony's side isn't finalized. And I just want to caution everyone that whenever you see someone flaunting a signed contract, because take it from me, as someone who tries to find out information from people, for whatever reason, fighters, managers, they're very afraid to talk about fights before the promoter. And it doesn't matter if it's UFC or Bellator or anyone else, before the promoter makes it official. They're very afraid. So all of a sudden, those few times when you see someone start to actually flaunt a signed bout agreement, you know that the green light is given to put pressure on the other side. Let's not be silly. Let's not be foolish here. We know exactly what's going on. All of a sudden, we're seeing signed bout agreements. We saw that with Usman and Covington last year. You remember that Khabib Nurmagomedov UFC 205 story that he got mad at me about? Why aren't you talking about my signed contract? It's because they were trying to put pressure on Eddie Alvarez to take the Conor fight. So that happens, and it's a part of the fight game. It's part of the business side of this game. I'm not saying it's dirty or anything like that. It's just what makes the fight game an interesting sport to cover. In boxing, you kind of see how the sausage is made a little more. In our sport, things are kind of kept under wraps, but as the sport continues to grow and social media continues to grow, you're starting to see a little more of this come out. And we're seeing it now with the Tony Ferguson situation. So just keep it locked here. We'll keep it real and we'll tell you how it really is. TST, did you learn a thing or two about the business side of MMA today? Did you enjoy that?
I did. I really enjoyed the me being the young person I am, the conversation about Instagram. And ever since like Paige said that on your Monday show, I've been really interested in that and, you know, diving into the numbers about it. So good stuff.
Thank you. And what about Gina Carano? I mean, you just learned who you were, would it be fair to say that this was the first time that you were exposed to the magic that is Gina Carano?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much every week that you bring someone on, you know, we had a conversation before the show last week. I was like, yeah, who's Randy Couture?
Yes.
And you're like, oh, he's only like the greatest fighter, one of the greatest fighters ever. And I'm like, I really haven't heard of the person until you've had them on their show, on your show, which you had not had Randy on since I've been working on your show. So I now know who Gina Carano is. She's awesome. Yes. Makes me want to watch The Mandalorian. Not even a Star Wars guy.
Right.
And she was awesome. She was a lot of fun. She's very smiley. And I can tell how much that whole interview meant to you.
Yes. Nice little corporate plug there for Disney Plus.
Of course. I'm a
corporate. You can, yeah.
I'm a corporate guy. No corporate Jake, though.
No corporate Jake. No. No corporate Jake here. But you know what you get here that you don't get anywhere else?
TST's Minimalist Tip of the Week.
You're darn right. Okay. So, Ariel. It is Wednesday. We're taking this podcast. That means Black Friday is in a few days. You know what Black Friday is, Ariel?
Yes.
It is the enemy of the minimalist. It is the minimalist's worst fear, Black Friday. So whenever you guys are going out Black Friday shopping, I encourage you, if you're buying something for yourself, you have to ask yourself the question, because there's all these great deals, right? Things are on sale. Things are in these glass shiny cases and whatnot, and everything looks really great. So if you're going Black Friday shopping, I caution you, if you're going to get something for yourself, ask yourself the questions, you know, because once I buy this thing, yes, and there is a shot of dopamine, that the happiness hormone, as I call it, mm-hmm. that comes with buying something. But you have to ask yourself this question, okay, after the rush of this wears off, after a few days, a week or two, am I still going to like this thing? Is it still going to serve a purpose in my life? So if the answer to that question is no, you probably shouldn't get it. And if you're buying something for someone else, maybe for the holiday season that's coming up, you have to ask yourself, is this something that they're going to use after like 2 weeks or so? Is this something that's really going to add value to their lives, to invoke that phrase again? What I do, Ariel, when I'm buying gifts for people is I buy people experiences. What can I get for them that they're going to enjoy? It's like a one-time thing. I got my dad a massage last year. Like, I get concert tickets or tickets to a game. Something that you can enjoy and maybe you can attend with that person. Tickets to a show. Something like that. So gift experiences rather than objects this holiday season.
I love that. You know, my son, who is 7, turning 8, some way, somehow has learned about Black Friday for the first time. And so he keeps asking me about Black Friday and keeps asking me to go to the mall on Black Friday because he wants to get Pokemon cards. And I keep telling him that it's not going to be a very enjoyable experience being at the mall on Black Friday. And certainly we're not going at 6 a.m. I would never do that. I don't understand anyone who would ever do that. I've only been to the mall once on Black Friday a couple years ago, and it was like at 2 p.m. And it was horrible.
It's madness.
Yeah,
it was horrible. Black Friday gets earlier every year.
Yeah.
And now there's all these different days. There's Cyber Monday and whatnot.
It's, you know, it's embarrassing to see people act that way. And it's also kind of sad because here you have Thanksgiving, which is supposed to be like, you know, it's supposed to be like so spiritual in the sense that you're just grateful and thankful and there's no religion attached to it. It's just about being around family and thankful. And it's about like the meaning of love and happiness and being around people that you admire and all this stuff. And then the next day everyone loses their mind and gets there at like 4 a.m. and just becomes, you know, these monsters trying to buy up all this stuff. So.
Yeah, the day after giving thanks,
yes.
You go trample other people to get the
horrible.
Latest Apple product.
Horrible, horrible. Well, thank you for that. It's great. And by the way, the jingle that you have at the beginning of your tip of the week, it's almost very non-minimalist, if you know what I'm saying, right? Did you go with that approach on purpose?
What are you talking about?
Well, it's very like in your face.
All right. Don't be one of those minimalists.
What?
You
know, what?
Those one of those minimalist haters that be like, oh, you're wearing pants today. Not very minimalist of you.
No, I'm just saying, like, you know, when I think of minimalism, I think of like Buddhist music or yoga music, whatever, you know, you would play at like some sort of.
Well, I need to change it again to
it's just been something that was on my mind. In any event, I believe we have a couple of reviews.
Yes, we do. We've got a couple glowing reviews, actually. 5 stars here from Juice.
What is this music?
I don't know. Just kind of music I kind of vibe with. It's not Canadian, I don't think. So Juice says, 5 stars. I'm a big fan of Ariel's show and have been for years. The new Wednesday format is such a treat. Ariel took a picture with me outside the Staples Center for the LA stop of the Mayweather-McGregor tour, and I later found out this was just moments after he found out he was pulled from the Showtime broadcast. I wonder why.
That's right, yeah.
No question. I just want to say I really enjoyed the Gareth A. Davies interview last week. Him being open about his health was so touching, and as a 2-time cancer survivor myself, I know how important it is to be on top of these things. I am also loving the minimalist tips of the week from TST.
Yeah, right.
I will not lie and say I am going to implement them, but they are very enlightening to my capitalistic, overindulgent self.
Wow, you wrote that part for sure. Ad lib.
I did not. How about that?
Okay. That was very nice, yeah. Is this like some sort of song that you would play at like a hockey game in between periods or something?
Timeout? It could be. Here's another 5-star review here from The Real Mellow Fellow.
Oh.
I'm telling you right now, there's no better podcast, period.
Wow.
Ariel keeps it real. He does the digging. He gets the facts. You'll laugh, cry, be inspired, say an amen, get mad, get sad, and laugh some more all in one podcast. MMA, boxing, wrestling, and basketball. You get it all here, folks. And there's one more part he adds in there, but I'm not going to read it.
No, read it. Go ahead.
This dude, TST, needs to let it go longer. This is 2019. We can listen to long-form entertainment now.
Yes.
Please let it go as long or short as it needs to organically. Other than that, this is perfect.
Wow. How about that? Warms my heart. And also, speaking of our great reviews, we have something exciting to share, right?
We do.
Tell them.
So, as you know, Ariel, the Helwani Road Show.
Yes.
Going to Vegas, Friday, December 13th, right? Right ahead of UFC 245 when my favorite fighter is fighting.
Yes, Colby.
Yes, Colby Covington. So, if you would like to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, where you can preferably leave us 5 stars, tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. And if you leave us a review and you're going to the Vegas show, which we hope you are.
Yes.
Once tickets are available, they're not ready yet, right, Ariel?
Yep, correct.
So once you leave us a review and you're going to the show, we will choose a review and you will get to go up on stage and join Ariel and the other people that may be there with him.
Yes. So we're doing the trivia show again for the Nose World Order belt. Stipe won back in June. And if you listen to that show and if you haven't, I suggest listening to it because it's evergreen. You can enjoy it whenever, maybe in between meals on Thanksgiving once you're done this particular podcast. And as you may know if you listen to it, each round the contestants get a sort of ask a friend if they don't know the answer to something, and they would just pick people in the audience. You will be locked in as one of those people, so there'll be no picking involved. You leave the review, you tell us you're going on December 13th once the tickets are on sale, and you will be locked in. So we hope that many of the listeners of this show and the Monday show will be there in attendance, and in the coming days we'll have more information on where exactly it will be on the strip, who will be there, how you buy tickets, what time it's at, all that stuff and more. I'm looking forward to meet and greet afterwards. It's going to be great. So the card is phenomenal. 245 is phenomenal. It's going to be amazing. And the night before, after the weigh-ins, you can come hang out with us. And I believe it's TST's first trip to Las Vegas, right?
First trip to Vegas, Ariel. Wow. I can't wait. Me and you partying all night.
Yes. Sharing minimalist tips. I mean, Vegas is pretty much like the antithesis, I would think, of.
I know. I've never had any desire to go.
So I can't wait to see how you react to being
there. All the things that Vegas is about are none of the things that I'm about.
You see, I think that's unfair. I think you should make that judgment after you actually experience Las Vegas.
Yes, These are all stereotypes.
Right? So I mean, there's different ways to experience and enjoy Las Vegas. I'm a big fan. I've been there many a time, and I feel like sometimes people just view it on the surface and just, as you said, follow the stereotypes. But there's a lot more to it. There's a lot of depth to Las Vegas. Much like there's a lot of depth to this podcast, and I appreciate everyone each and every week who listens, downloads, rates, subscribes. I love doing the Wednesday show. It allows me to do a bit of a different thing than Monday and also talk to different voices who may not be suitable for Monday. And today was one of those days. Martin Lewandowski of KSW. Check out their show on December 7th and congratulations to them on the success they've had over the last few years in particular. Tiki Gossin has done a great job with several athletes and done a great job transitioning from fighter to manager and coach in between. And so that was great to get his insight, and congrats to him on getting the title fight for Dominic Reyes against John Jones on February 8th in Houston. And of course, Hans Mollenkamp, who I thought was very insightful about the business side and the sponsorship side of things. I'm very appreciative to all three of them for coming on the show today. So we're out of time. That's it. The music is playing. I hope if you are celebrating Thanksgiving tomorrow, you enjoy it. Have some good food and good times with your family. And of course, we'll be back Monday for the regular show, Wednesday, and on it goes. For TST, for myself, thanks as always for listening. Enjoy the fights this weekend. Not a lot, but enjoy whatever is going on, and we'll talk to you next Monday.